Okay, I'd like to call to order the special meeting of the Infrastructure Planning and Sustainability Committee of July 7, 2021. Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Councilmember Beal?
I'm here.
Councilmember Hunter?
Here.
Vice Chair Walker?
Here.
Chair McCarthy?
Here. First item's approval of the minutes. Entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Second.
And these would be the minutes of March 10th, March 24th, and April 14th, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay. Our briefing item, big surprise, tide plants, non-interim regulations, review fossil fuel expansion and renewable fuels. So for those who are just tuning in, this will be the third meeting to discuss the Planning Commission's recommendations and other council considerations regarding the non-interim regulations for the tide flats, with specifically respect to fossil fuel expansion and renewable fuels. Planning Commission had recommended that expansion of fossil fuel facilities be prohibited and that renewable fuels only be allowed with a conditional use permit. So, there was a lot of council questions and considerations that we wanted to consider as part of the non-interim regulations, including the fossil fuel expansion prohibition proposed in the renewable fuel, new renewable fuel proposal. So that's why we're here in committee kind of working through it. Our first meeting, we kind of got just a baseline presentation of what the Planning Commission recommended with respect to fossil fuels and renewable fuels. Then we heard from a group of folks from the energy industry to kind of hear some of their feedback and concerns and recommendations. Our last meeting a couple weeks ago, we met with representatives of the environmental community and got to hear from the environmental community some of their feedback and concerns and input on these regulations. And so now we called this special meeting because we didn't have a chance really to digest it all at both those meetings to have a little bit more discussion amongst us. So the only thing I've asked Steve and Peter to do in preparation for this meeting was to look a bit more at the definition of renewable fuels and see if we couldn't. I know there was a lot of questions from my colleagues following the last two meetings, and one of them had to do with just how we're defining renewable fuels. We talked a lot about it at our last meeting, and so the goal here would be to try and Steve has gone back to the drawing board and tried to provide kind of a more specific definition of renewable fuels for us to look at in light of both conversations we've had. So that'll be the first thing we look at and talk about. And so let's just start there. And then my goal would be to kind of walk through the other amendments and kind of have some discussion about that as well, each of those amendments. And I probably will be hoping everyone will kind of volunteer their feedback. If not, I'll probably just start calling on folks so we can try and get closer to some sort of consensus on these. Although we don't have to come to consensus today because we still have just a little bit over a month. And we also have some other items to take up, like permitting at our next meeting. So with that, Steve, I'm gonna ask you to turn on your screen and just kind of walk us through what you've done. Thanks.
Chair and members of the committee, at the last meeting, I offered up a kind of a dense definition, word pack of a definition. And the committee asked to sort of unpack it, which I think is very reasonable. So what I've tried to do is clarify what's in it. And Claire, if you could put up that the slides or the first slide, that would be wonderful. The Oh, that's neat. So the first slide is just the definition that was presented last time. And there were a lot of different, and essentially what this is and what I'll be unpacking today, this contains reference to every program, every type of fuel, I should say, that state or federal government has chosen to incentivize to date. So this is the big list. And with the second slide, which we can go ahead and move to, what I'm doing here is I'm explaining what's all in that. So what is in that, of course, is the EPA program that has essentially, it's a federal renewable fuel program, references the federal renewable fuel standard. And it is focused on biofuels. And there are four categories to date of approved biofuels: biomass-based diesel, cellulosic biofuel, which, as it implies, is from types of cellulose, a category they call advanced biofuel, which is any renewable biomass that could include animal fat, for example, as opposed to just plant matter. It does exclude cornstarch. And then what they call, the federal government calls, total renewable fuel. And that is, for the most part, it's ethanol from cornstarch. And EPA goes through a fairly complex life cycle impact analysis for their renewable fuel standard, renewable fuel program. And they consider full, you know, production to burning. And based on that analysis, they list or don't list a fuel. And so ultimately, if we were to utilize that standard, it would be basically, we would look at the list to see what was listed. We wouldn't try to duplicate the EPA analysis independently, at least not at the point where we are currently with permit review. We certainly wouldn't do that. That's, you know, a function, I suppose, that could be added and budgeted, but we wouldn't today. The next component, which we've had a lot of discussion on, is the Washington Renewable Fuel Standard, which is still in the rulemaking category, anticipated to be complete in 2022. And we've limited that to credit generating fuels. So the renewable fuel standard in Washington, or the clean, I should say the clean fuel standard in Washington, because it is, that is the term, is based on a cap and trade program where fuels that are clean generate credits, which can be purchased by producers of fuels that are not clean. As we heard at the last meeting, that is, will continue to move. The standards will tighten over the years. And some fuels that would generate credits in the beginning will not be able to generate credits later in the program. Over the years, they will need to buy credits to continue to be produced and sold. Then there are two other Washington state programs, which are less well known, but they still are fuels that have incentives from the state. One is what they call renewable fuels, different from the federal renewable fuels, slightly different from the clean fuel standard, which is the new standard. And that includes renewable biofuels, renewable diesel, ethanol, and ethanol blends. And that's a specific statute. It's RCW 4319. And renewal, and it really is primarily diesel, but also E85. And so diesel is it's a fuel substitute produced from vegetable oils, animal fats. It meets a federal standard. And then also the ethanol component, which is denatured alcohol, E85, blend of ethanol and hydrocarbon. And then finally, there is another state statute called alternative fuels, and that is RCW 8208-809. And that provides a tax incentive to purchase types of vehicles. And in that statute, it is vehicles which utilize clean alternative fuels. And the definition in that statute for a clean alternative fuel is natural gas, propane, hydrogen, or electricity, when used in a motor vehicle only, meeting California emission standards. And so what the definition before you is it's an attempt to capture all of that. So every fuel that has an incentive from federal or state government is in the definition. So that's kind of the maximum sweep if we chose to include all of them. This would be a definition that would do that. And we wanted to present that to the committee so that you could, you know, there has been a lot of confusion, certainly in my mind, over the difference between renewable fuels, clean fuels, alternative fuels, and the dialogue with you know, advocates on different sides of the issue has included a lot of those terms and a lot of these types of fuels. So what I wanted to do, Peter and I wanted to do, was to capture them all, and then the committee would have them all before you, understand them all, and then be able to say, we think this should be in the definition, but this shouldn't. So this is an attempt to give you the whole world of possibility. And with that, I will be happy to take questions.
Okay, let's just go down the line. We might need to keep that slide up, though, I think, even though it's hard to see each other. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we do have the slide presentation. It was sent to us by Claire just shortly before the meeting. If people are using dual devices like I am.
Okay. Okay. Well, I struggle toggling back and forth. Let's maybe we just start with the vice chair. Any feedback on these, on this definition? I mean, I know we heard concerns at the last meeting about this, you know, too broad of a definition, right? So just kind of want to get everybody's thoughts on this.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is getting close. I think that adding these sub bullets is really helpful. Thank you for that, Steve. I have some questions about, and also I should say, appreciate the first one on the credit generating fuel under Washington Clean Fuel Standards. I think that's a really important change. I have questions about D and how that fits in with the clean fuel standards, because I understand that that might be currently under the clean fuel standards, but it is what we're moving away from that. And so I just maybe need a little bit more clarity, or maybe I need to check outside of this meeting with other folks about where ethanol and E85 are, but that was the one that stood out for me. Really happy to see hydrogen included in there. I know we've heard from TPU on that one. But otherwise, I feel like we're getting really close, so appreciate it. And I don't know if Steve or others have comments on letter D, but other than that, I don't have any other specific questions.
Councilmember, I absolutely do. And as I said, the purpose of this was to capture all the current incentive programs. But you are absolutely correct, of course, C, D, and E will all, except perhaps hydrogen, well, I think they will all fall under the clean fuel standard. And all of those existing programs, I believe, will be subsumed within the clean fuel standard. So all of these different fuels that prior have been the subject of separate statutes, separate programs, will all receive, you know, ratings or evaluations or however they're going to do it under the clean fuel standard. Some of those will be credit generating. Some of them will probably not be credit generating. They'll be maybe credit needing, at least as the program evolves. So that your comment is right on. But right now, because we don't have the Clean Fuel Standard program implemented, this is an attempt to capture everything that currently is incentivized.
So I guess if I could follow up on that. So as these items become non-credit generating, is our intention then for them to drop off of our list as well? Or is our intention with the way this is written to keep them on no matter what happens with clean fuels?
So that is a choice of that certainly starts with this committee. We can, for example, start with, because, you know, start where the state is right now with these allowed. And then when we can transition, or we can even write in a transition when the clean fuel standard is implemented, to, for example, say we're only going to allow credit generating fuels. And however that falls out, it falls out for the rest of these. But that's definitely a choice in terms of what the committee might choose to recommend. So I don't know if that fully answers the question, but that is absolutely
helpful. Thank you. And so I guess just for the purpose of the discussion, I guess that's where I would lean, is having a provision to phase those things out over time. So that's all I have, Chair. Thank you.
And I just wanted to add, Peter and I are trying really hard not to bake the cake for you. we want to give you all of the information and all of the choices and not, you know, so...
Okay, thank you, Steve. Thank you, Vice Chair. Councilmember Beal had to step away from the screen for a minute. Councilmember Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Stephen and Peter, for your work on tweaking this here. I concur with Councilmember Walker that the a breakout of A through E helps to put it more in perspective. And I am also especially appreciative of the presentation at our last meeting by, I don't remember the gentleman's name, by Puget Sound Clean Air Agency that really helped clarify for me about credit generating fuel, and you've addressed that here. I think it remains broad enough so that we don't inadvertently exclude some options out there, because it seems to be a bit of a moving target. And that is not a reflection on your work. It just became clear at our last meeting that it was challenging to come up with a definition that we can get consensus on. So I appreciate the work that's been done here. I think that Section D, the ethanol and the blends, we heard from the fossil fuel industry information about those, and that that is part of the continuum to start reducing our carbon footprint with regard to fossil fuels. So I do think it's important to have that included in there. I think it's also important just to remember that we're writing non-interim regulations here. We are not writing the sub-area plan, and that this is a stopgap until such a time that the tide flat sub-area plan is completed. And of course, I serve on that committee as well. And on that committee is where we have multiple stakeholders that are not represented there, that are not necessarily included in this process. So we have room for a grander plan that is in the offing that may well, by the time we get around to that, have more definitive information about the clean fuel standards. And again, we are creating something here that gets us, works for that period of time, which hopefully will be sooner rather than later. So while the work that we're doing here is important and will have great impact on the Port of Tacoma, we are ostensibly not writing the sub-area plan. So I don't know that we need I don't know that we need specific language in there that talks about a provision to phase out over time, because certainly I think that that's more the purview of what the sub-area plan would be doing. Anyway, appreciate the extra detail here, and appreciate the opportunity just to get this in just chunks here. It's a very complicated issue, more understandable, particularly for those of us that don't have the laser-like focus on this that other members of our council and community do. So thank you, Mr. Victor, and thank you, Chair. Those are all my comments at this time.
Hunter. Well, I definitely want to get Councilmember Beal's feedback here when he's able to return. So I guess I'll just go and provide my feedback. I, you know, generally think the definition's good. I think there's enough clarity there. I mean, for me, the biggest concern I have is coming out of this process, wherever the committee lands, is being able to provide the entire community, including the energy community and the environmental community, with certainty about what kinds of projects will be allowed and which ones will not. And so I think this is a strong step in that direction. Would concur with Councilmember Hunter. I just with respect to the ethanol stuff, because that seems to be, you know, how we're making gasoline just a little bit cleaner right now. I do think that, you know, with respect to credit generating and the timeline, I mean, in my view, if someone came in and wanted to build a project and that fuel infrastructure was no longer credit generating, then it wouldn't fit that particular definition. But I think big picture, I think you used the right word, Councilmember Hunter, stopgap. You know, we're setting a new set. We've been living under the interim rules since 2017, 4 years, probably live under the non-interim rules for, you know, at least a couple years more. And then while the sub-area planning process works out, I don't know, maybe it'll work out faster than that. Maybe these discussions will actually help tease these things out a bit more in the sub-area planning discussion. And certainly the rules on the CFS will come out. I think Craig Kenworthy said next year. I like the definition as written, but I'm, you know, want to get to a place with the entire committee where everybody's comfortable with it. So that's kind of my feedback on this. So I'm going to text Councilmember Beal here. or perhaps, so maybe what we do is this, colleagues, because there's four of us on this committee and only three are able to kind of talk through this thing right now. Let's maybe move to some of the other amendments that we had discussed last week. And then when Councilmember Beal shows up, we can bring him back into all those discussions. So I think maybe the first one to bring up, and Steve, I, for some reason, I apologize, thought that we showed your draft language as a slide at the last meeting, but I guess we didn't. But do you have that? I thought we had that on a group of slides.
I don't think we had that as a slide. So
I think we just sent it.
Find that.
So I'm just going to start with what I think is one of the easy ones here. So one was, and I believe that Councilmember Beal would be, we'll hear from him, supportive, because it was part of his amendment or his proposed amendment, one he sponsored. And this was the projects which have undergone environmental review and mitigated impacts. And this is the one that said, I move to allow additions to the existing fossil fuel facilities, which would create the maximum proposed capacity of a facility that was the subject of an EIS prepared and published by the city under RCW 4321C, Tacoma Municipal Chapter 1312, honored before June 2nd, 2021. That date would probably change, I'm guessing. And for which
Chair,
the city is-
can I ask staff to remind us when this was sent to us and who sent it, just so I can pull it up while we're talking?
Maybe the best thing, I'm gonna,
maybe we could get that sent again so it's at the top of our email box. I just sent a text asking that very thing. Christina, thanks.
So I have a document, Steve, that was titled IPS 2021 Potential Amendments REV3.
That is it, Claire. That is the most
recent. Is it? Okay. Yes. So I can send that to everyone, and then once I do that, I can share my screen. Does that work?
Yeah, let's do that. Thank you. And apologies to everybody. I should have asked for this to be on the slide deck. So let Claire, if you could just go to number 7. So, and if you don't mind, oh, you know what you're doing. So Steve, I did a bad job of reminding everybody what this is about. This is basically about projects that have already been through SEPA.
This is. So this is to cover circumstances where a project has had full review for a full build out and also funded mitigation for a full build out, but has not developed their second phase to date. It is arguable that they would already be vested, but this is to avoid conflict in that scenario. I have been asked what projects I'm aware of that would fall into that category, and the only project that I am personally aware of would be an additional processing pipeline for the Puget Sound Energy LNG facility. It would not be the tank, an additional tank, because the tank is actually built to the maximum capacity. It currently has double the capacity of the the pipeline, which they call a train, but is in fact not a train in the traditional sense. It is a pipeline that essentially compresses gas into liquefied natural gas. So that is the only project that I'm aware of that would probably fall under this. But again, it's to avoid conflict and arguments over vesting or not. So that's its purpose.
Okay, so let's just kind of do a little round robin on this and just get people's feedback, if you will. Vice Chair Walker, any comments?
Chair, I just wanted to clarify, you said that the date would be updated to whatever date we pass this. Is that?
Well, I don't know. Wouldn't it be or not? I mean, I guess it doesn't need to be. But
this date.
That was the date we had before the council.
So it could be updated. I don't know that it would need to be, but it's not. I don't think the date is material, other than we could also say before the effective date, for example, of the non-interim regulations.
Yeah, I'm supportive of this amendment. I think I would just like for us to be really clear with the community about that, in case there are projects that we don't know about at this moment that are, on June 30th or something. I would think we would know about them at this point, and it would be good to figure that out. But just being really clear with the public about that date, I think, is important. But yeah, I'm supportive of this one.
Okay, great. Councilmember Hunter.
I don't have any strong feelings about this one way or the other, so I'm agnostic on this one.
Okay, agnostic.
My opportunity to use an SAT word. Thank you. Appreciate okay. that.
I don't have any objections to it. I guess I agree with Vice Chair Walker that we'd have to, maybe Peter can find out whether or not there's other, projects we should be aware of, how much the date really matters. So, okay. Claire, can you go up to, they're all on the same page. I think maybe we just do, so numbers, if we go to number six, this was Vice Chair Walker's point last meeting, is if we have a definition that includes the clean fuel standard, then do we really need this? And I think the answer was no, we really don't. So maybe if this committee can reach that point where we're, which I think we will, but I don't know, remains to be seen, that allows for projects that meet the CFS. I guess the only wrinkle is, right, we're now modifying our renewable fuel standard where we talk about credit generating, which is, I think, something we haven't heard from. We're going to come back to you, Councilmember Beal, in a second on that definition, but let's just, if we get it right on the definition of renewable fuels, can we just scrap this one? I'm going to just round robin real quick. Vice Chair Walker.
Yep.
Okay. Councilmember Hunter. I got a thumbs up. Councilmember Beal.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
We're going to go back to the definition of renewable fuel standards, but a renewable fuel definition, clean fuel infrastructure. But six is kind of redundant. So we're just kind of trying to wipe things off the table as we work through these. So can we scrap six if we get it right with the allowing renewable fuel projects?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think, sorry I had to cut out there, I had a sort of an emergency call I needed to take. I think on the definition that Steve presented, I basically had a lot of the same thoughts that I think Christina brought up about the credit generating aspect and some of the feedback we got about E85 and blended ethanols being maybe credit generating at the beginning of clean fuel standard, and then long-term potentially becoming, or even short-term, mid-term becoming a deficit fuel. So I guess that was my only comment on that. And then the last question that I had on the definition that Steve displayed was, how do we know, how are our permit folks going to know that things like the natural gas and propane fuel would be for motor vehicles as opposed to being distributed for other purposes? Does it matter, or is it just meeting the definition of how the fuel is produced or whatever the standard?
Steve, can you, or Claire, can you pull that one up, the renewable fuel definition, back up again, please?
Yep, give me 1 minute.
Steve, are you tracking what I'm asking?
I sure am, council member. And at this point, as with really any other application, we would ask the applicant for information on that point, and they would have to provide us with something that says, here's, you know, where this fuel is for motor vehicles. And we typically ask for fairly detailed information at the beginning, but as we discussed in the last couple meetings, we don't really have an inspection enforcement arm. So could a scenario occur where the applicant gives us the information and says, yes, we're going to sell it via, you know, X distributor who will sell it to fueling stations, gas stations. And then later it goes somewhere else and we don't know about it. That's a real scenario, but that's really true of almost anything we do in permitting, because ultimately our enforcement is complaint-based as opposed to having sort of an active program. So we would ask the applicant, we would have that on record, it would be a condition of the permit, but then if it changes in the future, we wouldn't necessarily know.
And then Steve, on Section A and Section D, so we talked about this before this meeting, but you know, the credit generating and the timeline of the CFS program. The only thought I guess I had on that was the graph that Craig Kenworthy showed us at the last meeting, showing sort of like you can project out credit generating over a certain amount of time, but it does get adjusted over time. So, you know, the way vesting works, any credit generating fuel under the CFS, well, that could be credit generating in year two, but in year five, it's a deficit fuel. And similarly, ethanol and E85 blends meeting Washington state requirements. I'm not really sure, that seems really vague. Is that supposed to mean the CFS or?
It is its own separate statute, council member, that lists the requirements. At this point, the legislature hasn't touched that statute, or hasn't the statute for D and the statute for E, and actually there's a statute for C as well. They haven't touched those. They haven't sunsetted them. So I think probably the intention, to the extent it's been considered, is that the Clean Fuel Standard is so comprehensive that it will capture all of that, and that all of them will receive, you know, credit generating or credit needing status. And so they haven't touched those individual statutes. But there are three separate statutes that represent CD&E. I don't know if that gets entirely at the question.
Yeah, and I feel like we get into Nerdville over here with, you know, getting into ethanol and the blending, and I guess my high level feedbacks. I'm sorry, Steve.
No, I was going to say, council member, I'm with you. I mean, I had no idea that all of this existed. Yeah. So, but unfortunately, you know, for better or worse, industry and the environmental community have kind of compelled us to learn this stuff. I think because I was hearing these terms and these kind of things from every interest, and I didn't know what they were, so I had to go find out what they were. I think we're in that position now, all of us.
Yeah. I guess from my perspective, just a high, you know, I tend to get too weedy on this stuff, like anything with land use, but I guess my perspective that I guess I'm trying to give is, if we in the community are going to live with fuels on the tide flats, which are in the findings of fact report are low job generating, low job density, doesn't meet our standards there, doesn't meet our environmental goals. I guess my goal with a lot of this is to make sure that we're not creating sort of hula hoops or loopholes that could create dirtier fuels, right? Like that's the agnosticism, I think, as Craig Kenworthy put it with the CFS, is it doesn't exactly mean every fuel is going to be low carbon or no carbon or not be dirty. It only allows for a credit market and credit program. And I guess from what I'm hearing from the public and from what I believe our goals to be, I think we should be striving to do essentially what that kind of the first line of this whole definition says, is like, we're striving, if we have to live with this, to have a marketplace and an industry that is credit generating. So at least it's a cleaner fuel. It's not the best scenario in the world, but I guess that's kind of my goal. And without getting too weedy, maybe that's maybe not 30,000 foot level, but maybe at least 10,000 foot level, feedback from my perspective on it. And so that's why I was asking questions about the terms Washington state requirements and ethanol blended stuff. And it just seems to me like there needs to be a broader catch-all of like these things, if they're credit generating over the life of the CFS, which Steve, I remember you telling me, is it 2035 or 2040?
So it's 2035, council member. And the official state goal is to reduce vehicle fuel emissions by 20% below 2017 standards by 2035.
Okay. So maybe there's some way for this when we transition to the CFS to say like credit, like that an applicant can prove it's going to be a credit generating fuel through 2035 using the bar graph or whatever that is. I'm sure there's a way to do the math, but I guess that's my feedback on the credit generating portion of it. That's it. Thanks, Connor.
Okay. I think I'm tracking. So I just want to play in. Oh, Councilmember Hunter, you have your hand raised, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chris, for your comments there. One of the things that I said in your absence was that we need to keep in mind that this is a stopgap while we wait for the sub-area plan to be completed. Ostensibly, that's happening. One of the things that might be helpful, Mr. Chair, and Steve can help us with this, is as we move forward with this process, it would be, I think, helpful to get an update of what's happening with the sub-area plan. I'm on that committee, and I am not sure that I could give an update on that. And I think that might be helpful to put it into perspective where that plan is at. And on that docket for that, where is the discussion about clean fuel infrastructure there as well? And I think that might guide us in what we ultimately do here. So I know that the schedule is full with regard to these special meetings, but you know we're dealing with two sets of policies here, and I think it just would be for clarification to make sure that we understand that there is another bigger umbrella effort happening that this would be included in, might help us with our understanding and what we ultimately come up with regard to our definitions here of clean fuel. So just some thoughts here. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The fact that this is, as you said, the stopgap pending the sub-area plan process, this is the interim regulations part two, now the non-interim regulations. So and we know the CFS rules are going to come out within period of time. So this isn't the end all be all. I do want to maybe, if we can, just talk a little bit more about this, because I totally agree that you don't want to set standards that allow for long-term projects that aren't necessarily good to cite, you know, while you have these non-interim rules in place. But my concern with, let's say, linking the credit generation through, you've got to be at the end of 2035, you've got to be considered a credit generating fuel, is just that, okay, well, does that mean we're turning away projects or investments that are going to create cleaner fuel than normal diesel and petrol over the next 15 years? So, and that's where ethanol is such a good example. So yeah, E10 isn't the best thing on earth, but is it better than get for the environment than gasoline without it? I think the conventional knowledge is it is. So it's because this, I guess the way I look at credit generating fuel under the CFS would be, when someone comes in to build a project, you know, that at that moment in time, that fuel is either going to be in the credit generating column or not when they come in for the project. So I think, you know, the devil's advocate would say, well, yeah, well, that's why someone might rush to build a project that won't be credit generating. But I think that's where, I don't know necessarily that that's true, because the way the CFS is set up is, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're credit generating or not in 2023 or 2025. The fact of the matter is, if you're not, you're going to have to buy some credits, or you're going to be penalized. So this program that goes into place is building this market incentive to not build those types of projects, I think, anyways, at least it's intended to. But I think that Council Member Beal's point is really well taken. I don't know how to kind of reconcile that with, okay, but we've got 16 years of the CFS from whenever we passed non-interim rules to 2035. And during that period, are there going to be investments that are better for the air and the environment, that serve the community, that are good projects that aren't allowed to fit in? And that's basically the same way I feel about the ethanol. So I don't know, maybe the way I just throwing things out there to, rather than tying it to the end of the CFS, it's more thinking about the fact that, look, we know this is, from a regulatory perspective, this is going to be an iterative process at the state and at the local level for a very long time, that we build into our proposal some sort of, not sunset, but some sort of review after a finite period of time to address exactly those questions. I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's any thoughts on that. Vice Chair Walker.
Thank you, Chair. I would be really supportive of putting some sort of review in at a certain time or date, building that into what we propose. I also think that we need to be visionary with this. And so while there might be things that are being made now that are better, I think we want to think big and ask for what's built in our community to be really the next big thing and not an incremental step. So that's I would support just being really visionary with this, even if we know there is a built-in timeline, which I would totally support.
I appreciate that. Councilmember Hunter, your hand's raised.
That was for the comments I just made. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Councilmember Beal, you want to opine a little bit more on this, or should we just, we can kind of go back to the drawing board a little bit based on the everybody's feedback?
And yeah, I think that's fine. And I'll just second what Councilmember Walker just said. I don't have anything to say beyond that.
Cool. Okay. So we're going to go back and fine tune this thing a little bit more and bring it back to the committee next time. Claire, if you don't mind bringing up that, I think it was Claire, the white sheet of paper. The Word doc with the amendments.
Yep, let me do that now.
So if we can we scroll back down to 7? So Councilmember Beal, while you were gone, we discussed this. And this, I think, is basically the amendment you proposed. So we're just wanted to check the box and make sure you're okay with it. The only question that came up is about what date. And so we were going to ask staff to go back and look at the date. This is for projects that have already undergone SEPA.
Yeah, I mean, this is written a little differently. I mean, it's expunged of the amendment that didn't pass before this came to committee. But I kind of wonder if Steve has any input on this too, because I mean, he and I worked together on this language a little bit under the auspice of trying to protect the city from legal liability of things that we'd already done some environmental review on. So I don't know, Steve, if you had some commentary on it too.
Councilmember, this is exactly as you say. This was intended to capture only projects where a full build-out, you know, the maximum project had been gone through a full SEPA process and the full project had been mitigated, payment, construction, whatever that might be. But the applicant had only built a portion of the full project. Under those circumstances, certainly they'd arguably be vested, but this was intended to just avoid unnecessary conflict under those very limited circumstances. And as I told the committee, I'm only aware of one project that this might apply to from my own personal experience, and that would be the second fuel pipeline for the PSE LNG plant that would allow the tank to reach its total capacity. Currently, it's at half capacity. Councilmember Walker indicated we should really confirm that that's the only one, which Peter and I will work on. So I can only speak to that one as what would fall under that. But we certainly can and will confirm that if we are aware of any others that this would apply to. And we would certainly have that information. We would know if something had been through review, but not fully built out. So.
Well, Councilmember Beal, since you kind of worked on one of the initial iterations of this with Steve, maybe, you know, not put you on the spot necessarily, and you can take some time and read this, make sure you feel comfortable with it. I think everybody else, Councilmember Hunter was agnostic and Councilmember Walker and I, you know, were supportive. So I think that if you want to go back and look at it a little bit more before we meet next, does that sound good?
Okay.
Okay, cool. Okay, and if we scroll up to 6, this is the one I was just saying, I think it's redundant, so we can just scrap it. If everybody just gives me a head nod, we can move on with life. All right. So a lot of head nods there. Okay. And then what's 5? So 5 is marine vessels. So I think this one's definitely worth some discussion. So I'm going to start this discussion. So one of the things the CFS does is it exempts maritime fuel vesseling, or fueling of maritime vessels. And so, I think the way it's currently drafted that it needs some work, because obviously there's concerns with, the types of projects that would, that we already know the community doesn't like. but I do want to be completely respectful for the fact that, look, we've got an international maritime port here. We need, and part of that is fueling ships. And my understanding right now is most of these ships are on using bunker fuel, except when they're in the ECA, which is about 100 miles out of coast. And when they're in those areas, they're using some sort of distillate fuel that is basically is also petroleum based, but cleaner than bunker fuel. And I do think we as a community want to be absolutely forward looking and to accommodating and incentivizing the types of infrastructure that will support, fueling ships with cleaner fuels. But I think there are some, there's just some logistical issues with just saying, with not doing what the CFS already does, which is exempts maritime vessel fueling. And it's a big deal for the community because, look, the shipping lines, have some discretion in where they choose to land their ships, and we want to be competitive. And if we're not able to provide for that fueling demand, then they go elsewhere, and that really impacts our community. But certainly don't want to be encouraging or incentivizing fuel infrastructure that is long lasting and negative for our community and the environment. But I would love to hear some thoughts from some of my colleagues on this. The only reason I keep pointing to the CFS is because, it's kind of this issue's, not to say we have to do what the state has done, but the state is basically landed on this one and said, look, we need it at least for right now. When it comes to marine vessel fueling, we're going to have a carve out. And so, when you read, some of the articles from the environmental community on the CFS and you read statements along the lines of, this legislation is a victory for people's health, the environment, and economic recovery. I think I was reading this today in Climate Solutions. It makes me, and that was a CFS with an exemption for marine vessel fueling. Keeping in mind that most of these vessels, with the exception from the vessels that come from Alaska that are in the ECA, pretty much the whole journey and have to have that clean fuel the whole journey. The rest of these vessels that are coming, let's say from Asia, they have to refuel when they're in our community. And we have to provide a port that provides that type of marine fueling infrastructure. So anyways, this one is addressing one of the concerns I had. And I don't think the way it's drafted would fly with all of you or the entire council. So I kind of wanted to get some feedback on it because I do think you can't just have any project can go if it's quote unquote for fueling marine vessels. And that's not my intent, but there has to be some flexibility for projects to support the ships that call Tacoma. So anyways, I talked too long as usual. My apologies. Vice Chair Walker, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Chair. So I also want to clarify on this one, so the standard permitting process. So for example, if a fossil fuel facility that exists right now wanted to expand with the intention of fueling a marine vessel, they would go through a standard permitting process, which includes SEPA.
Yeah, so whatever the standard permitting process is, I mean, that's the intent.
Council member, if the SEPA threshold is triggered, absolutely, yes. So throughout when we use standard permitting process, that means including the SEPA threshold. Really, it's a way of saying not a CUP. but okay. Every other normal rule requirement, including SEPA, will apply.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I feel a little bit, well, as you said, Chair McCarthy, as written, that I'm not supportive of this. I think that, and I just don't think that there should be anything just sort of exempt from what we're trying to do, which is to reduce fossil fuels. So if there is a way, in my mind, it could be cleaner if this was included in one of the other amendments to sort of tighten up our list a little bit, that there's something that addresses marine vessels. I understand where you're trying to go with that, but I am pretty nervous right now in the way that it is written, that it could be some sort of blanket exemption or allowance. And appreciate the that, of course, it would still have SEPA. You know, nothing is just outright permitted, but it makes me a little nervous right now without having some more specific language. And just, I guess I'm repeating myself now, but maybe by the end, but by the time we get down to one here, there's a couple things that could be combined that we could address without having them called out individually. So.
Okay. I totally appreciate that. Councilmember Hunter.
Just a couple of thoughts here. It's my understanding that the International Maritime Association is already regulating diesel and bunker fuels. It's a sixth sense, and I only know enough about that to be dangerous on that. And I'm wondering if, Mr. Victor, if you could get an if it's possible, to get an update about what that current regulation is, so that if that regulation is in place, that accomplishes what we're trying to do here with regard to existing fossil fuel facilities. I think just to be making sure that we have a full picture, we don't inadvertently put something in there that runs counter to what the International Maritime Association is doing. And if the International Maritime Association has already done some good work, maybe we don't need it, or we can create language that supports that so that we get more of a global aspect on that. So just a little bit more attention to detail on there rather than just only relying on the SEPA. I think if there's something else in there, I would be interested to know what that is. And then if we want to just support that, we can, or then if we want to see some voids in there or we can beef that up, then we can do that at that time. But I think that's important information to have as far as marine vessel fossil fuel facilities goes. And then if we can roll it into something else that's already out there just for expediency and make it cleaner, as Councilmember Walker suggested, that would be great. But we've gotten the, when it comes to, you know, the clean fuel standards and all of that, we've gotten some great work on what's happening at the state level, what's happening at the federal level. I think we should also take a look at what's happening in that regard with marine vessels, fossil fuels. So
just we'll research that, Councilmember. Absolutely.
Okay, great. That's my only comment, Chair McCarthy. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember B.
Yeah, I on this one, I guess I'm still just hesitating a little bit because, again, kind of always go back to like this issue of we're not regulating throughput, and I'm a little concerned that we may be able to get an applicant to commit that this is for marine fueling today, but the infrastructure isn't necessarily, like the land use of the infrastructure isn't necessarily tracked long term. I struggle a little bit with like those two dichotomies of like, if they need more fuel, there's nothing stopping more production to go through the system, and expansion for storage and production for transshipment and transportation, that might be today, but I don't know. I mean, part of this might be that I just need some more information on how that's set up. Like, is there a certain way that marine fuel vessel? Yeah, I probably need a little more education on this one, but I guess I have more questions than guidance on being okay with it. So
appreciate that. Fair enough. So how about, sounds like this one needs some work to be even considered and some more information. So let me take this back and come back to everybody at the next meeting with some more thoughts. And as Councilmember Walker or Vice Chair Walker said, maybe something like this can fit in somewhere else. Okay, let's scroll up here to number four. So this is the national security one. I'm probably just going to defer to Councilmember Hunter to speak to this one, if she likes. I think we did get, Steve, maybe you, for the benefit of everybody else, we did get some more feedback from representative at JBLM.
Chair, we did. And the feedback we got was generally, as I read it, okay with this definition, but there was a desire to add some additional language to it, some additional words. And I'm working hard to find that right now.
I think I can find.
I didn't think it was materially different. The key to this for me was the written request, so that we would be able, you know, in permitting, we would be able to verify that it was in fact a request. And the committee's had some discussion about this, and I wanted to add, I at least in my own assessment, I don't think this is for a scenario where there is a deployment, an unexpected foreign deployment going on, and the military just needs a lot more fuel. I think that they would be able to secure that, without anything that we do obstructing it. I think this is intended, though, to get at a scenario where the military is considering deploying additional aircraft, for example, to JBLM, or they're assessing in terms of base closures again, whether, you know, what are the points, you know, that they would have for or against JBLM. And under those circumstances, that is a scenario where it could be more infrastructure that would need to be built. And if we have this exemption, then that could be a point in our favor, or it could address a situation where it makes it easier or more attractive to move additional aircraft to JBLM. So, I think the emergency one doesn't make a huge amount of sense to us at the staff level, but the scenario of longer term changes does. So, that's our understanding, and the proposed revisions were pretty minor. Again, I'm really trying to find them, but we will show those. It came in yesterday or day before, so it's not represented on this list, but they weren't material from my perspective because the written request remains.
I have it, Steve.
Are you looking for Mr. Adamson's
suggestion?
Yeah.
I sent it to you, Steve, at 11:20 a.m. yesterday.
Okay.
One of your 1,000 emails. So let's start talking about this. Councilmember Hunter talked a bit about this last time. I think the big question is just, you know, how do you kind of, which has been raised now a few times. Okay, well, how do you prove up? And I think our answer is, look, you know, we rely on what's presented to us by, you know, permit applicants. And, you know, we don't do much in the way of inspection enforcement unless a complaint's made. Steve, do you want to talk about some of the, what kind of enforcement tools do we have so a complaint's made, you know?
Well, ultimately, and I certainly would, you know, Peter probably has a better handle on this. Mr. Hoffman probably has a better handle on this than I do, but so he's certainly welcome to make comment on that as well. What typically happens if we get a complaint is we will contact the permit applicant, ask them to respond. If it's something that we can see visually, someone may go look at it, although we don't have inspectors, so to speak. And if it's a code violation, then of course we would refer it to code enforcement. So there are a number of paths, but there isn't an active investigatory follow-up type of approach. So I don't know if Peter wants to add anything to that.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add is it really all depends on the violation and the detail in the original complaint. Sometimes there's video or other evidence, but nonetheless, it does just turn into sort of a preliminary investigation where we have the complaint, we investigate the complaint, we look at the original permit, we seek information then from the applicant in regards to the complaint. And then it just becomes a process of working with code enforcement, which may involve sending out a PDS inspector. It could be an environmental services inspector. It could be depending on the scope of the violation or the complaint. And then we just inevitably what we have to do is we just have to follow the code process for, you know, the violation. And those are all varied depending on the type of violation. And sometimes if a violation is found and there is subsequent enforcement, depending again on the degree or the type of enforcement that is enacted, there might be some follow-up. Meaning, for example, if there was a legal tree cutting and part of the enforcement action was some sort of replanting of vegetation, we would then go out and make sure that that vegetation, one, was planted compliant with the enforcement action, but then there might be like 5-year or 10-year increments of follow-up to make sure that the enforcement action is followed through with and in a tree or vegetation is still living. Those are just some examples, but it really does depend on the type of it. And an example like on throughput and these types of things are new to us. So we don't really have any enforcement infrastructure for that. Although we do have that for like stormwater and those types of things.
Yeah. I'm the one who took us down this rabbit hole. So I apologize, but I think it's probably outside the scope of the non-interim regulations we're talking about, but I do think that whether that's new code or tightening up existing code in terms of enforcement authority and or inspection resources, I think that would be a great thing to consider in the sub-area planning process, Councilmember Hunter, because Peter just last mentioned stormwater. We have stormwater enforcement folks. The ironic thing is the port does too, because they're managing their permit. I think one of the great things that I think could come out of the sub-area plan is to really consolidate all that and beef it all up. Because again, this is also about building the community's trust in, if we're going to have regulations that allow for certain uses in our shorelines for good reason, then we also have to prove up to the community that we have, the infrastructure and the authority to hold people accountable. I think that's really important. Okay, Councilmember Hunter, I'm going to kick this to you, and then we'll go to the vice chair and then Councilmember Beal to get thoughts on national security.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had reached out to Bill Adamson, if you recall, he was at one of our earlier meetings. And so I had sponsored this amendment number 4, the National Security Fossil Fuel Facilities. We moved that forward and Mr. Adamson took that and reached out to more of the military community in the Department of Defense. I've just sent the updated response to the members of the committee here, and then I also sent to Mr. Victor and also to Claire, our support staff, if you haven't received that yet. So just a couple of things that I wanted to bring to the group's attention, committee's attention here. And this was, I did a little bit extra research last week after our last IPS meeting, where there was a sentiment expressed by one of our guests that if there was some sort of action of war, the military would then require us to provide the facilities. And that may well be true, but it's also important to realize that JBLM is a vital component, not only of national security, but also of our economic engine within Pierce County. And I don't remember how many countless jobs we have there, and then the ripple effect of jobs there. The military is constantly reviewing the military bases, and they do it through a process called base realignment and closure. And it's been about a decade, I believe, since that last happened. And now there is a plan for 2021 to resurrect that again. We need to make sure that we have a landscape here that is supportive of JBLM, not just in times of war, but just for regular operations. And so I think it's important that we have them called out specifically with regard to the fossil fuel facilities. And how does that play out with regard to our national budget? Again, you talk about going down a rabbit hole, Mr. Chair. I've gone down a rabbit hole on this as well. So if we look at the current proposed budget that President Biden has put out, there is EPA gets a 21% budget funding increase. The Health and Human Services gets a 23% lift. And Department of Defense got a 1.6%, not even 2% increase in their budget. So the concept of a base realignment and closure and that it might actually affect JBLM is a possibility. So we want to make sure that we are demonstrating through our policymaking that we are supportive of JBLM and want to keep that going. So that's just my little editorial there, if you will. I think that the Mr. Adamson asked a couple of really good questions here about the authority governs the standard permitting municipality. Why does Department of Defense need to follow jurisdictional permitting when the intent is to exempt DOD? And I won't read the entire email for you there, but I believe that the revised draft that he has sent with regard to national security fossil fuel facilities, very similar to what we have here, but it says, I move to allow expansion, modifications, and additions to existing fossil fuel facilities through the standard permitting process, where the project is requested in writing by an agency of the federal government to serve the needs of the Department of Defense supporting Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Naval Region Northwest installations, or other national defense needs. So I'm happy to put that amended, that revised draft forward, because we've gotten the stakeholder input there, and go with that. So I yield to any questions from my colleagues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Hunter. I'm going to call on the Vice Chair to get your thoughts, comments.
Thanks, Chair. I guess the same clarification question on this one as the last one about standard permitting process that refers to SEPA, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole, we're going to get into permitting on the 21st, but the intent
Councilmember, the intent of that is always to say it's not a CUP. So rather than saying without a CUP, we put in standard permitting process. But absolutely.
And I guess what I'm getting at with the clarification is that, again, we're not trying to outright say that something can be put in without a CEPA process, right? That we're not trying to sneak things through.
We are not.
And then the request in writing by an agency, are there any other examples in the city of something we do this for? Is this a standard process from other bases or other projects or other agencies? And I lost you a little bit on the earlier conversation about enforcement, but my understanding is that's sort of what this is about, right? So somebody enforcing that a company would expand with the intention of working with Joint Base Lewis-McChord and then change tracks. Can you clarify that's what you were talking about earlier? Because I got a little bit lost.
Yeah, well, okay, me, Vice Chair, on the enforcement piece. Yeah,
was talking about enforcement, so that I'm asking the question about what the enforcement where the enforcement conversation started, which is what I think.
I think the enforcement converse a thread in all these conversations has been, or many of these conversations for the past 4 years on the council, has been about, you know, not wanting to allow bad things to happen in the port, wanting good things to happen in the port, and trying to manage that through land use regulations. And we've heard kind of some the real world feedback from our permitting staff that, look, you know, we're not scientists, but we do review, you know, really detailed applications. We do go through every process that applies, which includes in many cases SEPA, which includes our shoreline master plan. But then, you know, after the project's built, we're not out inspecting necessarily. So my point was kind of the broader point that I really do think, and it might be outside of the non-interim regulations, that I really do think beefing up existing code or establishing new code that really clarifies that authority and or resources necessary for enforcement would go a long way to building the community's trust. And what Peter did is he kind of explained it's not like we don't have a process, we're complaint based and we do go enforce the code if there's violations. But I do think that's something that requires some special attention for all of these categories.
Okay, I heard that part, and I guess my question is two-part. One, do we have the request in writing by an agency, is that something there are any other examples of at either in our city or other cities with other bases? And then secondly, if we're talking about enforcement, is that a piece of the enforcement, or could it be?
So I think the letter, Steve and Peter can answer the letter. I think they're trying to come up with, you know, this would have to meet a certain threshold, right? Someone can't just show up and go, oh yeah, I'm building this for Joint Base Lewis McChord. So the threshold that Steve came up with in this draft was, you know, a bona fide letter that says, hey, we need this project to serve our national defense needs from someone with the authority. But Steve, you can give that more color.
Well, not a lot more. Councilmember, that is exactly the intent, is that it isn't just an industry representative saying we're doing this for GPLM. I cannot think, to answer the other part of your question, of another scenario where we do require that. Mr. Huffman may have more knowledge of that than I do, though, so I would defer to him.
I guess committee members, the only thing that I would think off the top of my head is there's some stuff in our special needs or housing ordinance where we do require some verification, some documentation from the state. It's particularly dealing with licensing, but we can do some research for you. And in those types of cases, that if a facility is built with that documentation initially, so while they're in permitting, they're creating a new facility or a new use, and they provide that documentation, and then getting into the enforcement, there is a complaint against that facility, we would check and verify that that documentation is still valid. So I guess in this situation, that if there was documentation from the Department of Defense saying that there was this need and the facility was permitted, and then we got some information that the facility was operating out of compliance with the original permit conditions, we would verify that that documentation was still valid. And if that documentation was not valid or provided from the Department of Defense, then we would get into an enforcement action, which I guess to the chair's point, at this point probably would need some resources and some more looking at what those enforcement code, you know, language would need to be in that case. But that's probably the best I got right now.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. And thank you for tracking my roundabout questions. So I think at this point, you know, I support the intent of this, but I am going to need a little bit more detail on the language and how it would be carried out before I'm ready to be full in on this one.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Totally appreciate that feedback. Councilmember Beal.
Yeah, thanks. I had to make jokes in my head that there's no such thing as city planning police. I had to make that joke. So sorry, that's probably just city planner humor. the question I have, for some reason, I remember the original, I thought the original intent of the amendment was like an emergency. This says to serve the needs of Joint Base Lewis McChord. Is this, I'm trying to remember, Councilmember Hunter, is this revised from what we considered or what we saw on the last night, like the second reading of the time extension ordinance, or am I misremembering that?
So the one that is on our screen right now, I believe, is what we saw on the last evening when we were discussing, or when we all started, when we had made our amendment, our suggested amendments, and then it was moved to IPS. And then what I read to you and what I have sent to you was the updated recommendation from Bill Adamson with the input of the military Department of Defense perspective. Is that what you were asking? Did that help?
Yeah, I just couldn't remember the intent. In my head, it stuck as like, to serve national emergencies. And I guess my original question was going to be for Steve, something we all learned during COVID, I guess when it came to other things like paper products, is doesn't the federal government, including, you know, the president, have National Defense Authorization Act powers to say, like, during a national emergency, and I'm reading FEMA's website right now, doesn't the president sort of have sweeping powers to like mandate, if it's a wartime effort, mandate these things, and the local jurisdiction doesn't have much say?
That's absolutely true, council member. There is a power that can be exercised, and I forget what the correct terminology is. There is a correct description for it, but it's basically a mandate: produce more of this, and it just has to happen. My recollection of the discussions, to the extent this helps, is that the question of non-emergent scenarios, like moving additional aircraft, for example, to JBLM, was also part of the conversation. And I believe that factors for base closure or realignment were in there as well. So all of that was discussed. But as Councilmember Hunter said, this is the amendment that was offered at the time. So this hasn't changed. There was not an emergency language one that was previously offered.
Okay. I mean, my initial thought was like the emergency stuff seems to be handled by other laws that already exist. The expansion just for basic day-to-day needs, I guess I'm a little bit concerned about it for a couple perspectives. I guess one, you know, it's not like Tacoma and the Pierce County area would be saying no to the base. But for everyday day-to-day needs, I think the context of where the fossil fuel facilities does matter, right? Like it's in a critical area for aquatic resources and environmental protection and protection of endangered species that's on a tribal reservation. And I guess my concern is like to serve the everyday needs of the base, I guess I would want a little more scrutiny over that. Particularly in this one, like issues like conditional use permits come up because then you do have a use issue, right? Like that use, that expanded use authorization is only through a conditional use permit. You have more of a hook to say those things were permitted, like that tank or that facility or this volume was permitted through a conditional use permit. And there is more of a fallback for city staff to have when it comes to what that use was supposed to be for, and abandonment of that use and change of that use is regulated through a conditional use permit. So I will just throw that out there. And I know that's probably getting really nerdy with people, but this is kind of what the day-to-day stuff that city planners deal with when it comes to land use permitting. The other part, I guess I would say, is if we go down this path of non-emergency serve the needs of, I mean, I still support, you know, needing the conditional use permit for the reason I just stated, but I also think we need to think about the facility needs to be filing affidavits with us certifying that they're still using it for that use, as opposed to the city being in sort of a, you know, again, to make a joke, a city planning police mode of going around and making sure that the land use is complying with the permitting. So that, I guess that's kind of what I'm thinking. Steve, do you have any thoughts on that, on an affidavit approach? I know we do that for things like the MFTE program, where people have to file affidavits every year certifying that they're complying with the agreement they entered into with the city. Is that something we can do through land use permitting?
I think we can, Councilmember, and certainly we do have an affordable covenant agreement that we have with, affordable housing projects. That isn't an annual thing, but it is a recorded covenant that is enforceable. So I don't think any of that is prohibited in the land use context. So yeah, I think that's possible.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Beal. Okay, let's that's good feedback for sure. So I'm taking notes. So for example, I'll just go through my list real quick before we get to these last two. So on number one, which the first was the definition of renewable fuel, I'm going to go back with Peter and Steve, take everything that was said today and try and make some adjustments and then bring it back to the committee at the beginning of the first meeting and talk some more. Number seven, which was the SEPA one, Councilmember Beal is going to take another look at the language and see if he has some more feedback or proposed changes. And staff's going to respond to Vice Chair Walker's question about the timing and what other projects are impacted. Number six, which was the redundant one we scrapped. Number five, marine vessels, which I spoke to. I'm gonna rework and bring back either as a standalone or part of one of the other ones we'll talk about here in a second. And national security, I'll get back with Councilmember Hunter based on the feedback we got and see if there's a way to fine tune this to address some of the concerns that were brought up. So does that sound okay for what I'm doing on the last ones we talked about, or what, is that a good, okay. Thank you, Vice Chair. Okay, so let's move up. So three is, this is maintenance, safety, security. Think replacement is there, required to meet regulatory changes. There's some nuance in here, obviously. So I don't know the best way to go through this other than all of us stare at our screens. Why don't I just read it out loud for the benefit of everybody? So this would be, I move to allow through the standard permitting process improvements to existing fossil fuel facilities which maintain or improve the safety or security of the facility or allow the facility to meet new regulatory requirements, including the state clean fuel standard, including replacement of deteriorated or obsolete infrastructure and infrastructure which reduces air emissions and stormwater runoff. Such improvements may not increase the storage, production, transshipment, or transportation capacity by more than 15% over their capacity at the effective date of these regulations. So, and this is tied to the 15% that's referenced in the last one we'll talk about today. But so I just kind of want to get everybody's feedback on this. I spoke a little bit last time about the 15%. You know, in fact, I wish I would have asked at least a couple more questions of our last panel, which totally appreciated their feedback on the whole concept of you know, not allowing for any expansion whatsoever. I mean, I guess from my perspective, I believe there has to be just a little bit of wiggle room. I think that generally speaking, well, maybe I'm just speaking to number two right now, I'm speaking to them both, but just generally speaking, when you're dealing with facilities like these in a growing community, we have to send a strong message to everyone that we are going to limit the storage and refining of carbon generating fossil fuel emitting products. And I think to a large extent, we've come a long way. 4 years ago, we prohibited any new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Tacoma. And we didn't limit the expansion of fossil fuel facilities, and now we're on the cusp of limiting fossil fuel expansion. So, and I support that, but I do think there has to be some buffer, some wiggle room in order to address the needs of our community, which is basically who these facilities serve. And I don't know that 15% is the perfect number. I do know it's not. I'm sure it's not. But I think there has to be some sort of leeway to allow for, you know, improvements to facilities that will that serve our greater community while recognizing that they're not substantial in scope and size and impact. So I guess I spoke to these both a bit. You know, this one deals mostly with, you know, the maintenance, safety, security. I think everybody's on board with that. I think you'll all tell me I'm wrong in a second, I'm sure. The replacement piece, we talked about that quite a bit at our last two meetings. Some of the other nuances in this one mention air emissions and stormwater runoff. So I'm guessing there's going to be some questions about that. But I think the idea is that basically if people are doing, we don't want to people to not do improve, let's say, for example, their stormwater facilities because they serve a fossil fuel facility. We don't want them to not improve them when they otherwise would. Maybe air emissions is a little too broad. So again, spoke a lot, probably not super eloquently, but that's my two cents on really the next two we're going to talk about. And kick this around, start with the vice chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. And I was going to ask if we could take these two together. So I think that's great. I think I certainly am supportive of number three in the way that it allows existing facilities to update things. I think it's, I really love the intention of improving infrastructure, reducing air emissions, stormwater, all that language I think is really good. And in fact, you know, that was part of the intention of the amendment back in May was if you're changing to renewable fuels and there are things that need to be changed, by all means, let's do that. So I think this gets at that intent that I was pushing for earlier this year. So I think some version of this I'm really supportive of. The 15% to me, I'm curious, I think that I've heard you say, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, Chair, that's a little bit arbitrary. And I would like to see that be lower. I think that unless there's a really good case to be made that we need to increase capacity to make changes, to just clean up infrastructure, to me, that doesn't, it doesn't need to be that high. I appreciate the wiggle room, but I think we can do better than that. And then as far as the outright permitted, I think I know, Steve, you're going to tell me that be permitted through the standard permitting process just means no CUP, but the word outright permitted, I think is we can get rid of that, unless that's a planning term that I don't know. That raises red flags to me. And I don't know, at this point, I don't think we need to allow 15% over capacity without some other piece, as is written in number three. So that's where I'm at this point.
So, Vice Chair, I'm just going to ask you a quick question. Just the last thing you said about 15% in number three, I'm not clear if you,
I don't. I think we could say 5%. And I think that would give wiggle room to still update infrastructure to make improvements needed and still get at the intent of what we're trying to do and still provide that wiggle room. I haven't heard anybody give me a clear argument about why 15% and not something lower.
Yeah. And one of the reasons, I don't know that it's arbitrary. It's just when we in 2017 considered limits on fossil fuel expansion, I think that was the starting point was 15. At that time, a lot's changed in 4 years. I could have that wrong. Maybe it was lower. But I do think I appreciate your comments. And would you? And I love what you said about saying the fact that outright permitted just, and I get what the intent is, but it kind of rubs you the wrong way. And I think that makes sense. So anyways, let's appreciate your comments. And I, I think let's move on to Councilmember Hunter. You're next.
Thanks, Chair. Again, I want to gentle reminder to this group that we are creating a stopgap here. We are not writing the tide flats or the tide flat sub area plan. And I think that numbers could be tightened up at that time as that moves forward. And perhaps once we get these non-interim regulations in place, it might be an incentive to move that and have that be a point of focus there. What's always curious to me when this was, and I was on this, number three was one of my amendments, or I worked with someone on this, is that, and I don't think that it is one that can be combined with number two. I think those two are completely different. And if the fossil fuel facility expansion, maybe we can, you know, work with the number there to have that be less than 15%. But one of the, and if you recall when we had our fossil fuel industry here, is that as they were working with those blended fuels and they upgrade those facilities and they bring in, you know, and we look at the tank farms, you can't use one of those tanks at, you know, this month for one certain blend and then the next month for another blend. There's some cross-contamination there, and they pointed that out as one of the issues that they had as they were looking at increasing their fossil fuel, or excuse me, their renewable fuels effort there. I think 15% is appropriate in section number three. I would be willing to discuss it for section number two. And then the other thing, though, that I also think we need clarity on, and certainly this has come under the sub-area plan, this has been discussion as well, 15% of what and when, and how is that measured, and who does the measurement? So, you know, it becomes, you know, we really need some more clarity on just what that means. And we may not get that with these non-interim regulations, but that is a clarity that could perhaps be a focus, and maybe more appropriately so, with the large umbrella overriding sub-area plan, where we do have the representation of all of the stakeholders at the table to move forward with that comprehensive plan. So that's my 2 cents worth. I think the 15% for number three should stay. For the stopgap effort there. And this gives those facilities down there the opportunity to update those tanks for the lower carbon fuel so that they and blends that they're moving forward, and also allows them just to do their basic safety. So those are my thoughts on that. And I defer to I would imagine that we might have a separate discussion for input on number two on there. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Hunter. Councilmember Beal.
Yeah, this expansion issue, I feel like, is sort of the line in the sand for me. I don't know how we get there. I mean, we started this process by saying we're not changing the findings of fact. And this feels a little like we're just bartering over a number that feels somewhat arbitrary and based on code that's, you know, 4+ years old, 5 years old, if you count when it was developed. And so I feel like the landscape's changed a lot. I'm just not sure how we get there on the expansion, particularly not outright. I don't know how that would even work. The other part too is on the permitting for safety and security and changeouts and retrofits. I mean, correct me, Steve or Peter, if I'm wrong. I mean, I feel like we already have code that allows for maintenance activities. Was there something built into this that nullified, I don't know, maintenance and security and safety requirements? Did it say it was prohibited?
Councilmember, the concern, as we understand it, is that, for example, if if a facility is replacing old tanks, let's say, and they're replacing four tanks with one tank, a new tank, new design or something like that, of similar capacity, but that was perhaps, you know, availability was limited to something slightly larger, that the code could be applied to say that they couldn't make that upgrade. And there was just a concern that that the code could be applied to say you cannot replace, for example, although they would not be non-conforming uses under the Planning Commission proposal. They would be permitted uses, so there would not be that issue of non-conforming. But that there was some scenario where these type of activities, these changes or reconfiguration to affect these, I guess, benefits, could be considered to be new infrastructure and prohibited on that basis. And, you know, it's a lot of hypotheticals, but I think Peter can certainly speak to, we do think there's a possibility in some not necessarily clearly foreseeable scenario that the code could be applied to say you can't make a change that would actually be an improvement. And Peter might have more to add. And that wasn't a great answer, but that's the thinking.
No, I don't really, Steve, have anything to add. I mean, it just may not be a one-for-one in-kind type of capacity improvement. So there might be a slight change in capacity to meet the improved safety, security, or even clean fuel standard. And we just didn't want to be prohibiting that.
Yeah, I think that seems fine. I can go along with that intent. That makes sense. The clarification piece. I just can't get there with the 15% expansion. We would need to build a case. In reading, and I've read the findings of fact report a couple times now, it's so clear in its message about not allowing expansions unless they're related to renewable or low carbon or no carbon fuels. I just don't know how we get there with the number. I would need a lot more time to process through what's the case for that. How do we shoehorn this into the existing environmental review for the code? The findings of fact would seem askew relative to the final code adoption with council. This just requires, it feels like a lot more work to even get to that point, because I don't know what 15% means. I would need to know a lot more about that. And it feels opposite of all of our policies. It feels opposite of the findings of fact to go down this path. And it feels a little like we're kind of bartering over something that I don't completely understand. So that's kind of where I'm at on it.
Yeah, I think that's really good feedback, Councilmember Beal. And I think it's something kind of need to think about a little bit more. I mean, I think the way I kind of look at it, or at least some of my thoughts are, you've got, what is it, six facilities that this in the tide flats that this these regulations apply to, and we want, at least from my perspective, we want them investing in their facilities, investing in making those facilities more efficient and cleaner and better. And what we don't want is those facilities frozen in time until they're obsolete, rotting away. And so right now, under the current construct, you can expand your facility by 17,000%, right? I don't think the footprint's there, but that's what the code language allows. Of course, nobody's done that over the past 4 years. Not to say there haven't been some projects, because there have, certainly. But what this does is it just provides some buffer that says, look, you can build out a little bit more, but you know, you can't do anything of substance that will have those extraordinarily long-lasting negative impacts that we are concerned about as a community. But you can certainly continue to invest in your facility and make it better and better. And so it just provides that little buffer between, you know, right now, which is 1,000,000%, and what's been proposed by the Planning Commission, which is, you know, frozen in time, just a little bit of a buffer. But I totally, and I think the way that the, I think Steve will correct me if I'm wrong. I think, because you asked that question at our first meeting, you know, are we going to make findings of fact? And I told you, no, this committee is not going to make findings of facts. But I think that if there was a limited expansion allowed, the way that would work, and the full council was willing to entertain that and approve it, the way that would work is the council would, at adoption, make those findings of fact. But just say, you know, for small projects that improve your facility, that don't have substantial impacts, you know, up to a certain limited percent. And I think the intent was to tie the percent to capacity. I think you and both Council Member Hunter raised a good question about, well, what does that mean? So that's something we need to talk with legal some more about. Okay. Councilmember Hunter, you wanted to talk about two separately. I brought them together. Councilmember Beals talked about 3 and 2. I just won't stop talking. Councilmember or Vice Chair Walker's talk. Do anyone else want to offer some feedback and comments on number 2 before we kind of move on? Okay, everybody's heads down. Okay, so moving on. So I have, I just to sum up, well, I won't say that word. On number 3, sounds like there's some general consensus, although there's some concern with the percentage increase. So let's bring that up again. At our next meeting, is we're going to bring all these up before we talk about permitting. And then number 2, I think I've heard everybody's feedback. So perhaps I can go back and since this is one, I know I was not the, or I'm led to believe I wasn't the only council member who supported number 2 back when these originally got before the council, at least in concept. So I'm going to go back and work on that a bit and bring it back to everybody and see if there's, with all due respect to my colleagues, see what, if there's any warmer feelings, and if not, then not. But I appreciate everybody's honest, forthright feedback, because I think we really made some progress tonight. And we're 2 hours in. So let's, if there's no other comments, before I call on Claire, or before we go to topics for upcoming meetings, does anybody else want to make comments? Councilmember Beal.
Yeah, there's one thing, Stephen, I'll bump it back up in your inbox. There was an amendment I mentioned at our meeting, I think in late June, about the South Tacoma MIC and some stuff that the neighborhood council that Councilmember Hunter and I have been coordinating with them on. I sent it to you, but I did fail to follow up with you on working on a draft for consideration and made some assumptions. So I'm going to just resend that to you. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, Councilmember. And I do have that. And I'd invite Peter to add as well. So we did look at that. One of the concerns we have, and I should have looped back with you, is it appears that those are outside of what the Planning Commission conducted public hearings on, that it's outside of the scope of their recommendation. So we had some concerns just about scoping that within this process, because it did not appear to be, it appeared to be new. There is, as you know, a companion comp plan amendment that's going through the process currently. But at least it appeared to Peter and I and the other staff that it was new. So that raised a concern for us, but we can, we'll follow up with you.
Yeah, if you could, my understanding was there was some confusion over like, because I think the original request was apply it to the entire groundwater protection district, which clearly is way out of scope. I was under the impression that as long as it fell within the South Tacoma MIC, that we could look at it through this process. So if we could follow up, that'd be great.
Yeah, we'll follow up with you. Absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
And I would just say, if there is a piece of that that can be within scope, let's get some language in front of this committee to look at. Okay, seeing no other hands raised, topics for upcoming meetings, I can just read this. July 14th, our meeting's canceled. July 21st, it's not on our agenda, but July 21st, we're talking about conditional use permits and standard permitting. After we talk about these slate again, after we've done the homework we discussed tonight, and then July 28th, Claire? We're here July 21st talking about permits, right?
You got it.
Okay. Then July 28th, Planning Commissioner interviews, and then we'll be talking high impact and chemical uses. So sorry, Claire, I stole your thunder. Let's just move on to anything you want to add, Claire, before we go to public comment?
No, you covered it.
Okay, public comment. I'm going to go ahead and read as well, Claire. You don't have to. Only written comments will be accepted for this meeting. Please submit your public comments to IPS Tide Flats at cityoftacoma.org. Comments will be compiled and sent to the committee, which they were this afternoon. And they're also posted on the Tide Flats Interim Regulations page at cityoftacoma.org/Tide Flats Interim. Clerk, do you want to tell us how many written comments we received in time for today's meeting?
Chair McCarthy and members of the committee, we received 25 comments since your last meeting on June 23rd.
Okay, and just for the public's information and for the, we're accepting comments on a rolling basis. You can submit comments whenever you want, and the committee will be reviewing those comments, and they're also available for the public to see online. So with that,
Sorry.
Is that right, Katie?
Yes, that is correct. And all of the comments received in total are on that webpage that you mentioned.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I think we're done. Good meeting. We'll be ready for the next one. I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
All right. We stand adjourned. Have a great night.
Thank you. Bye. Very much.
Good job, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.